My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to first of all thank the committee for asking me to come out and talk. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. And I want to welcome anybody that's new here. I know it's a group of newcomers in the back, and safe to say, whether it's good or bad, I was a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous for the better part of two decades. And I mean, it was ridiculous. I don't know if there's people taking chips tonight, but I had taken chip after chip after chip. I recycled through Alcoholics Anonymous from the time I was a teenager until I was in my 30s. And I had had so many chips I could have played poker with them all. And it was absurd. It was ridiculous. What I would do is I would go into your head and look back at myself and think, what a loser. You know, and the old timers weren't doing that. But I was doing that, and I was judging myself. And, you know, there was so much guilt and shame about being a newcomer because of what I thought you thought of me. Eventually, I started coming to meetings drunk. And I did that for years. I remember my sponsor who's here tonight, you know, used to pick me up and take me to meetings loaded. And he would just say, show up at the meeting. And, you know, I hated you people. I couldn't get this thing. Part of the reason I couldn't get it is, as I found out later, is I wasn't willing to give anything. And I thought I was going to come here and magically hear some tidbit of information that was going to miraculously change my life. And beyond that, I started going through treatment centers. I don't know if anybody went through treatment here, but ultimately I went through treatment 28 times. It was ridiculous. And I remember telling my sponsor, I said, you know, I went through treatment 28 times, you know, hoping he's going to perceive me as a hopeless case. And what he said to me is, he said, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, you're kidding. He says, no, it means you paid $500,000 for a big book. I didn't think that was funny. And you know, I always thought the problem was alcohol. And a guy said to me, he said, you know, if your problem's alcohol, he said, that bottle of Jack Daniels, that's your problem? He says, you're probably not a real alcoholic. And then he said, if you're an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in our basic text, it ain't alcohol. And you know, I couldn't wrap my head around that. But I was asked some very specific questions about my relationship to alcohol, and I saw the great fact for me was that I couldn't live without alcohol. For any considerable period of time, my experience was that I couldn't live without booze. And, you know, treatment was a great place for me to fatten me up for another run. But it never solved the problem. You know, I'm not going to start citing pages tonight, but page 101 of the big book, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation, doomed to failure. It was great to solve the problem for a moment, but it never really solved the problem. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous again and again and again, and I recycled through these rooms, and I never really understood what the problem was. And I can remember sitting in one more detox, dying of alcoholism, 120 pounds. I was lost. I was dirty. I was hopeless. And, of course, I'd let everybody down one more time, you know. And I'm sitting there in the detox circle, you know, a vision for you, right? And this woman comes in from AA, you know, in her business suit, one of Clancy's crew, and she does her AA talk, and at the end of it she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her and I looked at the guy next to me and I said, what a bitch. And you know what she said? She said, the reason I wouldn't do it, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And as sad as that is, all of these years later, I understand that that journey to recovery, like that journey to surrender that we have to get through, it's personal. I can't transmit that to a newcomer in this room. I wish I could give you that gift of desperation, that intangible element, that cover charge that seems to be a prerequisite to get in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you know what? Nobody could give it to me. And it wasn't an intellectual pursuit. And until I had done all the disgusting, despicable, diabolical things that a lot of us have to do in order to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, this is, by the way, the highest priced club in the world from my experience. And until I had done all of those things, I could write all day long on step one. It meant absolutely nothing to me. And I wish I could give that to you, if you're new. Or if you're in your last 30 days and you're thinking about blowing your brains out after this convention, you know, because I know what that's like, and I've been in that position over and over and over again. Not being able to live with alcohol and absolutely having no concept of how to live and thrive without alcohol. And trying every imaginable remedy, losing in every possible way before I got to that place where I conceded. And I gave up my right to drink. And I became willing at that point to listen to some of these wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous that had walked before me that were living a great life. You know, and I do a lot of H&I. H&I, I was told in the very beginning, hospitals and institutions has the lowest relapse rate in all of recovery. And I got involved in that, and I have a panel up at the VA, you know, and we like try to talk to them about surrender, you know. You get in a room full of soldiers and start talking about surrender, really, the room gets really quiet. I mean, they think you're like the enemy or something. Right? Especially Marines. But if you ever watch a soldier surrender, and one of the greatest illustrations that came out of that experience of surrender was this. If you ever watch a soldier surrender, you'll see him take the rifle, lay it down on the ground, sit down on the side of the road, wait for someone to tell him what to do. When you got 40 AK-47s pointed at your head, you don't throw down the gun with an attitude, right? You know? You're sitting on the side of the road looking back at your gun, you know what I mean? Someone will shoot you. And that concept to me, I understand today, is absolutely unconditional. You know, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, who's one of the contributing members to some of our original literature, talks about the difference between surrender and compliance. And I had been in these rooms for many, many years behind compliance. And I'm sure there's some sober living people in here tonight that may be doing it because of bad luck. You got a court card or, you know, an official document. And I went through that over and over and over again. You know, maybe doing it for family services, to get the kids back, or maybe to get the trust fund. There was a million forms of compliance. But until I got to that place of absolute surrender, that unconditional place of surrender, I wasn't teachable. And nobody could really talk to me about what the common problem was or the common solution. And what I understand today for myself is that there was a huge difference between the act of surrender that got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the state of surrender that's keeping the old-timers here. Big difference. Kind of like watching a swan glide across a still pond of water. It looks so graceful. It's so simple. But you know what's going on under the water, right? It's paddling like hell. And that was the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I don't know if we actually are in a state of grace just by definition, but I found that by taking certain actions that I've been able to maintain some kind of state of surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous and have some kind of freedom. And, you know, understanding things like, for me, fear wouldn't keep me sober. And I thought it would for a minute. Getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, giving up my dreams, my career, my family. I don't know if scared straight worked for you guys, but that went right over my head. Big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. By definition, a problem drinker is somebody that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason. And I really had to look at some of those considerations. Was I a problem drinker? And my experience was that I wasn't. I couldn't stop given any conditions. Big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a drunk tank for, say, drunk driving, you've got two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker on one side of the cell thinking, man, I knew I shouldn't have drank so much last night. Why did I drink so much? Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why did I take Interstate 10? Right? So if you're in here with a court card tonight, I know it's bad luck, and I feel for you. Problem drinker's wife says, now, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, gets a little Visine, doesn't drink in the house, you know? Huh? If my woman says to me, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. You know, that's the reality of the way that I think. Call it a distorted perception, if you will, but the reality is in order for me to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous today, if anything gets in the way of my recovery, just like if anything got in the way of my drinking, it was out of my life. You want to see some drama? Get between an alcoholic and a drink. Huh? If anything gets between me and recovery today, it's out of my life. If a woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how good it makes me look, how good she makes me feel, what she can do for me. I remember the first time I said that from the podium. I walked out of that meeting and there she was. And it was Thanksgiving. And she said, you know, you can have just one glass of wine, can't you? Another three rehabs. It's true. If anything gets between me and Alcoholics Anonymous, it's out of my life. That's been part of my experience on what it takes to maintain some state of surrender here. If a career gets in the way of my recovery, absolutely the same thing. I got a lot of sponsees. They pay more in taxes than I make all year. Doing wonderful. They get these huge careers in these little tiny AA programs. And my experience is I haven't seen any of them maintain the long haul here. Now, a problem drinker can probably do that. My experience is, what do I do for a living? Me? I stay sober. I maintain a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What do I do for money? It's over there. Every time I get them mixed up, I'm in handcuffs. Again, that's just been my experience. And I don't lose everything out there. I just give it away. You guys know what I'm talking about. Knowledge wouldn't keep me sober. That was another thing that eventually I had to take a look at. Because, you know, I had had every relapse prevention class known to man. You know, you learn all that stuff and you learn about your triggers. You know what? Waking up is a trigger for me. Right? All of that education, all of that therapy, and you know what? I'm sitting there behind a dumpster on Skid Row with a bottle of Jack Daniels in my hand, reciting chapter 5 out of the Big Book. And I know it verbatim. And the bum next to me is like, dude, will you shut up, man? You're ruining my high. Still behind that dumpster. And I'm trying my eyes out because I can't get back here. And one more time, I've got a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous and a belly full of booze. And I'm separate, different, and alone one more time. Which is almost equally as painful as being an Alcoholics Anonymous for a long period of time and not working the 12 steps. Coming to meetings late, leaving early, and I did that for years too, and that was equally as painful. You see it, you go into a meeting with 300 people and they say, well, all the people that are willing to sponsor stand up, and three people stand up. It's like, what's everyone else doing? An 11-step program? Because until I became willing to reach into my community and help other alcoholics to a solution, I couldn't find a solution here. friend of mine said there's three prayers in this life. One is, God, help me. It's like that act of surrender that gets us into these rooms. One is, God, give me. It's probably the greatest distraction on this planet. And the most evolved prayer is, God, use me. And until I got to that third position, I couldn't understand what this was all about. Again, the reason I couldn't get anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wasn't willing to give anything. And I thought that knowledge would solve my problem. If you're new in here, and you think you're going to get a little information on your triggers and relapse prevention, maybe you will. I drank with people that drank just like me and got a little information around here. And, you know, I see them with a baby carriage and, you know, they're fine. That wasn't my experience. I told my sponsor I had a degree when I came into AA. You know what he told me? He said, thermometers have degrees. You know where they stick those? He wasn't very nice, you know. He's vicious. And he wasn't impressed with all that, because it was a fact that the knowledge, although it's absolutely necessary for me to transmit a message and win the confidence of a newcomer where no one else could, the knowledge was insufficient to keep me sober. See, the knowledge was something that would help me to win the confidence where the clergy couldn't do it, where the therapist couldn't do it, where the psychiatrist couldn't do it, the parole officer couldn't do it. Another drunk was able to win my confidence. Because he felt like me. The same things happened to me. He perceived his reality like me. He lived in resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear like me. And when he shared that experience with me, I saw it. And I heard the common problem. I heard the common solution. And I understand today that that knowledge is absolutely necessary. But in and of itself, without walking and talking at the same time and taking this back into meetings to newcomers, it was insufficient to keep me sober. And you hear it at the end of every meeting. You ever, you know, they don't say keep coming back. It works if you know it, right? Think about that. Information. It works if you work it. And for me, this was like it says in the 12 and 12, which, you know, set of principles, spiritual in nature, only through their application would relieve me of the obsession and render me usefully whole. Set of principles that I had to adopt and implement and apply in my life. And as a result of that, eventually I got spiritually free. Thinking it through doesn't work for me. I love that one. I heard that for years. Oh, just don't drink no matter what and think it through. Play the tape through. You know, now, I'm driving my new car downtown past Skid Row and I'm thinking it through, playing the tape through, bumper to bumper traffic, and I'm thinking, Skid Row wasn't that bad. Little toothless honey, cardboard box, bottle of Jack Daniels. I could make it on Skid Row. Stress-free. All my problems turn into one problem. Just give me one more drink. Problem solved. That's the insanity of alcoholism. And I always thought insanity was doing the same thing and expecting different results. You hear that in AA every day. Guy said to me, you know, for us, insanity is doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's going to happen. Doing it anyway. And that was the insanity of alcoholism for me. And people told me, don't drink no matter what. And I know they mean well. And I thought that's what it was all about until I read the third chapter. You know, it talks about things like, I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. That I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. I can't just say no. It's kind of like walking onto a cancer ward and telling a cancer patient, you know, maybe you don't need to do the chemo. I didn't do it, and I'm still here. You know, maybe he had a milder form, for example. You know, and then I read the chapter to Wives, where it talks about the type 4 alcoholic, and there's 4 specific types of alcoholics. Now, I never read the chapter to Wives. You know why? Because I didn't have a wife. But that fourth type of alcoholic in the chapter to wives is the guy that drinks on the way home from the hospital, assuming he's been in a hospital. You know, and I started to see that I was never mildly intoxicated, that I was always insanely drunk. And I'd been placed like that fourth type of alcoholic in institution after institution after institution. And I had become absolutely hopeless. See, hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I've become hopeless. Hope doesn't matter to me until self-reliance has absolutely failed me. And that, again, is part of that journey that we get to in surrender. That I could write all day long on it. I couldn't conceive of that. It was so simple that it was beyond my comprehension in many ways. The insanity of doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's going to happen, and doing it anyway. It's kind of like having sex with a gorilla. Now, as graphic as that may be, if you have sex with a gorilla, it ain't over till the gorilla says it's over. You start healing up a little bit, you know, get that gorilla back in the cage. It starts looking at you again with those loving eyes. Baby, I won't hurt you this time. Come on, just let me out for a second. Nobody's going to know. Man, it's been 90 days. You know, and I did that over and over and over. I remember talking to my sponsor about, you know, going through chapter 5. It talks about people that are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I'm looking around the room, and he says, "What are you looking for? That's you." And I'm thinking, you know, and he said that I would tell myself that lie again, and then I'd believe it. That's the insanity of alcoholism. Reminds me of this story about this guy that gets a rifle for his birthday. And, you know, this guy goes up, he always wanted to kill a polar bear. I mean, this was his thing, he was a hunter. So he goes up to Alaska, and, you know, he sees this polar bear, and he takes his shot, and he goes over to check out his kill, and tap on his shoulder, it's a bigger polar bear, looking down at him. "You just shot my son. You got two choices. Either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death." A couple weeks later, he's healing up in the hospital. Now he's got a resentment, right? He's going to go back up there and get this polar bear. So he, you know, heals up, gets out of the hospital, he's got this resentment, goes back up there, sees the polar bear, takes his shot, goes over to check out his kill. Bigger polar bear. Looks down at him and says, "You know, that was my uncle you just killed. You get two choices. You either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death." Back in the hospital, healing up again. This goes on for year after year after year. Finally, he's back up there, you know, a little tore up. He sees this polar bear, king of the polar bears, takes his shot, goes over to check out his catch. One more time, this is the real king of the polar bears. And he's looking down at him, and he says, "You know, we've been watching you. You're not really up here for the hunting, are you?" Now, normies may think that's a little peculiar, but like the jaywalker, it's not so bizarre for people like us. And I always thought I was drinking because I was having fun. And people would say, "You're killing yourself." They'd put me up in a mirror with 10 guys in a, you know, in a meeting and say, "You know, you're killing yourself. You look like you just walked out of a concentration camp." And I thought I looked good. And I never knew that just like that guy that goes up there maybe to redeem his pride, going back up there out of resentment, that behind this insanity, behind this alcoholism, there was a spiritual malady. that was killing me. And I couldn't conceive of that. I never understood that. What was it, that spiritual malady that moved me back into that obsession, that obsession that moved me into the allergy, and then the allergy that ultimately would kill me. And it was like, I couldn't live with it, I couldn't live without it. And you know, the longest trip that I ever took, the longest journey that I ever walked, was that little tiny hyphen between the first and second half of step one. And really coming to terms with what that unmanageability was. You know, big difference between admitting I'm a real alcoholic and actually accepting it. To concede to my innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic, that I'm bodily and mentally different. It's like it had to go from my head to my heart, and like we say, that's the longest journey there is. That journey to surrender, like that journey to recovery, it seems that many, many of us die. You know. I have a friend that's a cardiologist that ended up on Skid Row, and it's like, you know, his son's arguing with me that his job at Starbucks is more important than AA. You know, and I can't give him that surrender. I can't give him that concept. I remember my friend Johnny Siegel, who passed away, he used to talk about being in a hotel in Mexico and standing up on this cliff and looking down at this the shoreline, and there's this little white strip of water that goes out into the ocean, and he's standing there talking to one of the guys that works in the hotel, and he says, "What is that little white strip of water?" And the guy that works in the hotel says, "It's the saddest thing, it's a riptide." And every year we get these tourists, they get, even though they're great swimmers, they get caught in this thing, and they fight and they swim and they get tired and they drown, and every year we lose like 10 or 11 people in this riptide. And Johnny says, "It's ridiculous. It's only a few feet wide. It just goes out a couple yards. Why don't they just let go?" Now, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, it's like looking at that riptide from that hotel as opposed to being in the middle of it. And that perspective changed as a result of taking actions that I didn't believe in. And that spiritual malady that I didn't even know existed. You know, a lot of people come into AA and they drank exactly the way I did. And, you know, the literature talks about it, in the doctor's opinion, that there's people that are normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. And those guys drank exactly the way I did. They even experienced the phenomenon of craving. But as soon as they put down the drink, everything worked for them. They fit in, they're part of, the career welcomes them back. They never work a step. Their life gets continually better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. And they look at me and they say, "You drank again?" My experience, every time I put the drink down, the first thing they'd say to me is, "Boy, you need to be on medication. Why are you so angry? Why are you so emotional? How come you can't sit still back there?" I'm crying at dog food commercials. When I'm not drinking, I have a whole other set of problems. Okay? They're outlined on page 52. When I'm not drinking, I can't control my emotional nature. When I'm not drinking, I'm a prey to misery and depression. When I'm not drinking, I can't manage my personal relationships. When I'm not drinking, I'm full of fear. When I'm not drinking, I'm basically unhappy. When I'm not drinking, I'm of no use to other people. It's outlined on page 52. And the way that plays out for me in untreated alcoholism is I don't fit in, I'm not part of, you don't understand me, everybody's in my way, life's not treating me right, I'm underappreciated, they're not paying me enough, she's cheating on me, I gotta drink. And you know what? As soon as I pick up a cocktail, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. A couple more drinks, I lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in myself. Three or four more drinks, fear of people and economic insecurity leave me, I'm buying a whole bar of drinks. I'll write you a check. Give me a couple Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. Give me a little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. Huh? You know what I'm talking about. Get me down to my last $20. I'll show you how my experience will benefit others. Alcohol creates the illusion that my life is manageable. And I never saw that until it was pointed out to me. See, what it actually says at the end of the promises, and we suddenly realize that God could do for us what we could not do for ourselves. My sponsor said, take a look at alcohol, not in the last 5 years, take a look at it in the first 5 years, when it really created that magic, when alcohol gave us that power. Didn't alcohol create the illusion that our lives were manageable? And when I agreed to that, he said, well, then there's a relationship between God and alcohol. And you can see it by substitution in the promises. And he said, you know, if you get into the ghettos in this country where everything's been burned to the ground, there's two things that always stick out. They're always there. Churches and liquor stores. You know why? Because they both give man hope. That thing we were just talking about. Hope, which doesn't matter until self-reliance has absolutely failed us. But they both give man hope. And hope's an interesting thing. So you got the old-timer and the newcomer looking at a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, and the old-timer says, hey, that's the way out, let's go. You know what the newcomer says? It's the oncoming freight train, I'm getting out of here. Completely different perspective. And again, that's the product of the experiential learning process that I went through in the steps. I really had to take a look at that relationship between God and alcohol, because it was there. Carl Jung said it in a letter to Bill Wilson, relating spirits to spirituality from the Latin root. And what he ultimately said was that for people like us, alcohol is an artificial means to a spiritual experience. These 12 simple steps are a practical means to a spiritual experience. You take the booze away from me and you don't give me something better, you think I'm going to survive in these rooms sitting on my hands, not drinking no matter what? Not a chance. Now, there may be people that can, and I've learned that that's none of my business. Until they ask for help. But I had to get to that place where I saw that when I'm not drinking, again, that set of problems is right there. Unless I can experience a sense of comfort and ease that I found from alcohol through this process, I'm not going to stay here. Because when I'm not drinking, I'm chasing you four exits past my exit on the freeway. I'm jumping up and down on your hood in traffic. I'm counting your items in the checkout line. Right? When I'm not drinking, I'm so separate, different, and alone by nature. My own mom is like, for God's sake, will you just drink? You were nicer. Have a cigarette while you're at it. And unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease through this process, I will not stay here. And going back to what the real problem is, because I thought it was alcohol. A guy named Chuck C. used to say the problem isn't alcohol. He said the real problem here is a conscious separation from God. And then he pointed to the 11th step and he said, and there's the solution, a conscious contact with God. And I came to understand that that bridge from 2 to 11 for me was steps 4 through 9. And whether or not I was willing to take those actions. See, you hear in the third tradition, the only requirement for membership here is a desire to stop drinking. That may be true. They'll let anybody in here. But I think there's another requirement on page 25 in order for someone like me to stay here. And it talks about none of us liking the leveling of our pride, the soul searching, the confession of shortcomings that the process requires for its successful consummation. And there's three elements I eventually had to look at. One is process. It's steps 4 through 9. It's a requirement. And consummation implies completion. Maybe what they should say is rarely we've seen a person fail that's done steps 4 through 9. Rarely have we ever seen anybody do 4 through 9. What I do is what's known as the AA walls. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. You know, and I eventually started to see what that conscious separation from God was. We have a chapter in our book, by the way, We Agnostics. It was very eloquently pointed out to me that we don't have a chapter in our book, We Believers. And I had to look at some of the considerations that had actually led me to that conscious separation from God. Because it was there. You know, and I had put a set of finite human conditions on an infinite power, and because of that I'd slowly become separate from that power. I didn't want to pray. I didn't want God to find out where I was. Now there's a conditional relationship. You get in the closet and pray for a hot dog, guess what? You starve to death. Now, I don't mean to offend anybody, but these are some of the old ideas that held me in bondage. You know, I believed for many years in a Santa Claus. God, if I was good, I was going to get a reward. And when that didn't happen, again, I became more and more separate from that God. I remember our friend Craig, who passed away, when he came and spoke in a meeting in Santa Monica about 5 years ago. And he had talked about, you know, Wilson talks about me being the actor. Forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and all of the players. If everybody would do as I wish, life would be wonderful. And a lot of us identify with that. But what Craig said was that in that scenario, what I had done all of my life is I had given God a role in my play. And when God didn't meet my finite human expectations, what I slowly did was became more and more separate from that God. And what this process has done is shown me a way to eventually face and be rid of the things in myself that were blocking me from that power. And I couldn't do that on my own. You know, initially, I had to come to believe in a power other than myself by default, because self-reliance had absolutely failed me. And initially, it was a group of drunks. I love Bobby Earle. If you guys have ever heard the analogy of the Eskimo, you know, he was my Eskimo. That comes in the story of a priest and an atheist, and they're in a bar in Alaska, and the priest looks at the atheist and he says, "How come you don't believe in God?" And the atheist looks back at him and he says, "You know, I tried God once." And the priest says, "Well, what do you mean?" And the atheist said, "Well, I was out in a blizzard. I was walking around in the snow in this blizzard, and I knew I was going to die, so I got on my knees and I said, 'God, if there's a God, help me, I'm going to die.'" And the priest looks him right in the eye and he says, "Well, you must believe in God. You're sitting here." You know what the atheist said? He said, "Now you don't understand. Right after I got off my knees, I bumped into this Eskimo, and he showed me the way back into town." So, you know, initially, this power was a group of drunks. It was a group of alcoholics that were willing to show me a way back to a spiritual connection. And over a period of time, that became good orderly direction, and at the other end of the steps it eventually became the powerful hand of a loving God. And what I've come to understand today for people like me is that there's a big difference between believing in God, having faith in God, and ultimately trusting or relying on God. And that evolutionary process, again, was something that slowly occurred over a period of time, like an educational experience of the spiritual variety that the Big Book talks about. For some people it happens immediately. For me, again, it was a process. And, you know, talking about that Eskimo, there's a great poem in Notre Dame, and it says, "I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three." And we talk about that nothing ensures immunity more than intensive work with others. And in the midst of one drunk working with another, I found that power. And my sponsor said to me, "Look at the 12 steps like the face of a clock. When you're in 12, you better be in one with a new guy." And it was that simple, that it would be a cycle that would last me a lifetime, that I would grow and evolve and learn. And every time I got to 12, I would re-experience the obsession with a newcomer. I would re-experience the allergy. I would re-experience the hopelessness, re-experience the delusion, re-experience the selfishness, and again, I would get more clarity. And it was the most powerful thing that I never saw that coming. I wanted to get stuff when I came here, on the outside. And it's been exactly the opposite, that by giving, I got something way more powerful than that. And eventually, it becomes good orderly direction. Big difference between faith and trust. It's kind of like if there was a high wire across this room, and like, say, a tightrope walker with a wheelbarrow started walking across the tightrope, we don't look at him and we'd think, well, he'll probably make it. He's up there. That's faith. You know what trust is? You go get in the wheelbarrow. Big difference. And eventually this evolved to a place where I became willing to take actions that I didn't believe in. You know, when someone like me is not having a good day, it's when I'm not getting my way. And eventually I had to take a look at it. It reminds me of this analogy of this ship, and it's out on the ocean at night, and it's sailing across the water. And the helmsman, he's the guy that steers the ship, he gets on the radio and he says, turn your course 10 degrees to the north. He sees this light on the horizon, so he radios to the light. He says, turn your course 10 degrees to the north. A couple minutes later, there's a reply, no, you turn your course 10 degrees to the south. You know, the light's getting closer and the helmsman who steers the ship starts panicking and he says again, turn your course 10 degrees to the north. A couple minutes later, there's another reply, no, you turn your course 10 degrees to the south. So, you know, they're arguing again and again. Finally, the captain gets on the ship, and he says, I am the captain of this ship. We demand you turn your course 10 degrees to the north. Again, the reply is, I'm a seaman. So what? You turn your course. Final radio address is, we are a battleship. We demand you turn your course 10 degrees to the north. And the final reply is, I'm a lighthouse. And, you know, that was me not getting my way. All of my life, I was in conflict with everybody and everything. That was my alcoholic mind. And like that ship, in order for it to change its course, it has to have facts about itself. Nautical speed, longitude and latitude, it has to know its direction. In order for me as a spiritual being to change my course, I had to have certain facts. I had to understand what resentment was, I had to look at my conduct, and I had to look at fear, which is my faulty relationship with God based on self-reliance. And until I could get those facts down on paper and go through inventory with somebody, I couldn't see the truth. And I was dictated and governed by my own feelings. And it was like, again, that's what moved me back into active drinking. Driven by resentment. You know, resentment in Latin means to re-feel old injury. The problem is what I do with resentment. If anything harms, threatens, or interferes with my perception, I immediately go back to resentment. What I do with it is I take poison and I hope you die. And that was the ultimate problem. You know, that I was driven by it. Like esteem. Don't you know who I think I am? Pride. Don't you know who I pretend to be? Security, what I need. Ambition, what I want. Again, if anything harmed, threatened, or interfered with those old ideas that I had established, I immediately went back to resentment. Which, for me, it's like an acid. Resentment is an acid. It only eats the container it's in. And I was poisoned by resentment. And eventually what this process did was showed me a way to face and be rid of the ideas that I had established over a long period of time that drove me back into that resentment. Howard P., I think, lives out here now, and he used to talk about baby elephants in Africa. And what they do with baby elephants to train these things is they chain these baby elephants up to these trees so that every time the elephant tries to get away, it gets, you know, it's chained to this tree, and the elephant comes to believe that it can't get away. When these elephants grow up, they grow up to be monsters. And all they do is they take a little wooden stake and a little tiny rope and they tie it around the elephant's foot. And when the elephant tries to get away, it remembers the chain. There could be a fire in that jungle. It's historically proven. Those elephants die right where they stand because of a belief system. And that belief system had been so established in me that I just couldn't see it. And when we talk about relieve me of the bondage of self, I eventually became aware of those chains, those old ideas. And through inventory, I became free. I remember they asked Michelangelo, you know, what it really says in the third step is, step three has little lasting effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that are blocking us. It doesn't face and cope with. It doesn't say face and endure for eternity. How about face and whine about from the podium? It says face and be rid of. A friend of mine said, you know, it's like, you talk about some of these steps we balk. Usually we balk at 4 and at 9. And it's like, you know, you tell a little kid, go in your room and straighten out your room. He doesn't want to do that. You tell that same little kid, go in your room and throw out all your old stuff and we'll buy you new stuff. How long would it take him? Right? And when I started looking at inventory from that motivation, that I could face and be rid of the things in myself, the bondage of self that had been blocking me from a spiritual path. It's like looking at that riptide from up here. It's like, why wouldn't you do this? But you can't tell a newcomer that. You know the only thing that people like us do in moderation? You know, right? The steps. To face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from a spiritual experience. They asked Michelangelo, they said, how did you make the statue of David? And Michelangelo said, I never made the statue of David. All I did was chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. What a simple process to face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from a spiritual experience. And I couldn't do it on my own. I couldn't change. If I could have changed, I would have changed. And the next thing they tell you is, if you don't change, your sobriety date will. That's pretty scary. You know, you hear a lot of things in AA that aren't necessarily in the literature. Like, how about don't judge anybody? I love that one. You ever hear that? Don't judge. 5 minutes later, they're telling you to stick with the winners. Huh. I got that from a friend of mine. Another guy said, don't make any decisions in your first year, any major decisions. Then take a look at the third step. How about don't get in a relationship in your first year? That's a great one, right? No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. So this guy comes up to his sponsor and he says, you know, I was in a restaurant last night and I paid with a 20 and the waitress gave me change for a 50 and I don't know what to do. And the sponsor says, well, maybe you should give the money back. The girl could lose her job. So he goes and he gives the money back. A couple weeks later, the sponsee and the sponsor are out having dinner, and the sponsor pays with a 50, and the waitress gives the sponsor change for 100. Sponsor puts it right in his pocket. Sponsee can't believe it. They get outside the restaurant, and the sponsor and the sponsee are standing there. The sponsee says, I saw that. She gave you too much money. How come you didn't give it back? Sponsor looked him right in the eye and said, it bothered you. Now, don't get this the wrong way. We're not saints around here. But what eventually happened for me is that I started to find the things that bothered me. And the things that bothered me at 6 months sober absolutely changed at 2, 3, 4, 5 years sober. And by doing inventory and looking at the things that were blocking me from a spiritual experience, from discovering the obstacles of my path, as it says in chapter 6, to ascertain in a rough way what the trouble is, to put my finger on the weak items in inventory, I started to discover the obstacles in my life that were objectionable. And I started to see the truth. You know, I was asked to look at relationships, which is the big, you know, taboo in AA. And, you know, what I was asked to do is take those 9 questions on page 69. Where I unjustifiably arouse bitterness, jealousy, suspicion, where am I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, where am I inconsiderate, where am I at fault, what should I have done instead? I was asked to take each relationship that I was involved in and subject each relationship to the 9 questions, to put it out on paper. You know, and by doing that, I started to have another awakening. You know, and the beauty of that is I was asked, if I had a daughter, what kind of man would I want my daughter to marry? And to look at that ideal. Now, I've taken the most diabolical creatures through the steps, and you know what? It's always the same. Loving, compassionate, loyal, considerate, generous, understanding, supportive. It's like the fundamental idea of God, when it's looked at objectionably, from an objective, is always the same. And eventually, by acknowledging that, I was slowly able to incorporate that into my life. It's like I would put down the drink and pick up the fork. Until I got to the same pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that I did with alcohol, with gluttony. Then I started acting out with credit cards. You know, and there I am in Vegas trying to bum money to get home. You know, and I'm back on my knees with the same pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Then I'm acting out in the rooms. Can't go to this meeting again. Can't go to that meeting. You know, and we all do that. There's like 400 12-step programs out there, and they're all identical except for the first half of step one. And what I would do is I would play musical poisons in the first half of step one, and I never really addressed the problem. The big book talks about when we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically. And 4 through 9 were identical, and when I did 4 through 9, I got free. You know, I hate to say this, but if someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. You know, a lot of us identify with that. If someone did to me what I did to others, I probably would have killed them. And when I came in these rooms, like I said, you think I want to pray? I thought God had been watching. I was bankrupt in those 3 basic relationships. And when I really looked at the steps remedied those 3 relationships. Steps 1 through 3 recreated and developed a relationship with God. Steps 4 through 7 recreated and developed a relationship with self. Steps 8 and 9 recreated and developed a relationship with others. 10 maintained my relationship with self. 11 maintains my relationship with God. And 12, having had an awakening and working with others, maintained my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps for the first time in my life, I'm able to live in harmony in those simple, basic relationships. And I never saw that coming. You know, one of the most tired analogies in AA is the one about the little kid, and I'm sure you guys have all heard this, but the people that haven't. Little kid comes up to his dad and wants to play with his dad, and the dad says, can you see him? Busy son, get out of here. Little 5-year-old. So he's trying to get the kid's trying to get his dad's attention. The dad grabs a little map of the world out of a magazine. He rips this map up into like 100 pieces, and he gives it to this little boy, and he gives the little kid some tape, and he says, what I want you to do, son, is I want you to put this little map of the world back together, and when you're done, we'll play. And he's thinking it's going to take this little kid an hour. The little boy comes back in 5 minutes, and he's got the whole map of the world all taped back together, and the dad says, that's impossible, son. How did you do that? And the little boy says, well, Dad, on the back of the map of the world was a picture of a man. I just put the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. And, you know, going through rehab 28 times, I'm an expert at putting the map back together. I can get the girl, the job, the house, the car in 90 days, lease it all, and every time I was loaded. Every single time. One more time, back in detox with a get well card. Another broken heart. And you know what? This was the spiritual technology that rebuilt the man. 1 through 3 with God, 4 through 7 with self, 8 and 9 with everyone else, and then helped me to maintain those basic, simple relationships. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? He said, love God with all thy heart. Love thy neighbor as thyself. These simple, basic principles are built right into the steps. They're as old as history itself. Problem is, you know, if you're a real alcoholic and God scares you out of these rooms, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you right back in. And that was the ultimate fact for me. There I was at that turning point. You know, we're the only people when confronted with, you know, go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. Now, if you were to go to a Walmart and do a survey and say, you got 2 choices, jails, institutions, and death, happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. You go to your local, like, detox and ask the same question. You get a variety of answers. I talk to my counselor. Can you come back tomorrow? What kind of death? How bad an alcoholic death? You know, being a newcomer for all those years, I mean, good or bad, it seems to be now, looking back at it, it was a fate worse than death. Death scares me less than living like that. Trying to get back here, living in what we would call Alcoholics Anonymous purgatory. Now, purgatory is an interesting thing. This guy's in purgatory, and he wants to know the difference between heaven and hell. So he's got this angel there. And the angel says, well, what do you want to see first? And he says, well, let me see hell first. So he goes into this room, and there's this huge banquet table, a buffet of every kind of food you could possibly imagine. You get about 40, 50 people. They're surrounding this banquet table, and they're strapped to these armchairs, and they got this, like, 4-foot silverware duct taped to their hands, and all this food's in front of them, and you can see it. They can't feed themselves. And they're stuck there for eternity. You can see they're starving. You can see the agony on their faces. But he says, that's awful, he says. Let me see heaven. And he goes into the next room, and it's exactly the same banquet table, same buffet, all the same food, same people, same armchairs. They've got this 4-foot silverware duct taped to their hands. And he's looking at it, and he can see that they're having fun, that they're nourished. They're laughing. And he takes a double take, and he can't figure out the difference. And then he sees the difference. The difference between heaven and hell is that in heaven, they're feeding each other. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. The reason I couldn't get what I was looking for here was exactly the reason, because I wasn't willing to give anything. And my sponsor said, what do you want from AA? And I said, well, I want a yacht and a Learjet. I grew up in Malibu. And you know what he said to me? He said, if you work steps 4 through 9 and you consistently live in 10, 11, and 12, what you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart. And I looked at him and I said, what do I want that for? Now, if you look at it in inventory, I think it's 65, 66, Wilson talks about the grouch and the brainstorm. You know what the opposite of a quiet mind is? You guys know. It's a mind that won't shut up. It's a mind that's up at 3 in the morning telling you you're a loser. You're fat. They're going to do the background check on you. They're going to find out who you are. She really doesn't love you. It's a mind that's up 5 minutes before you every day saying, I've been waiting for you. You guys know. See, you got the same thing going on. And what's the opposite of a loving heart? It's a vindictive heart. It's a prejudiced heart. It's a hateful heart. It's a resentful heart. And the product of this process was that eventually I got a quiet mind. All of my life I was crucified between two thieves, yesterday and tomorrow. And yesterday I had guilt, shame, and remorse. And tomorrow I have fear, anxiety, and worry. It's a no-win situation. And the product of the 12 steps is that eventually I got a quiet mind. Our spirits are like a body of water. When they're perfectly still, they best reflect the heavens. I know how to get there with a bottle of booze. But unless I can find the sense of comfort and ease that I sought from alcohol through this process, why would I stay here? And what's the product of this? When they say, if you want what we have, you know, what I found is a way to navigate around the drama. A way to match calamity with serenity. A way to pause when agitated. To be a productive member of my community. You know, and I hate to say this because it's going to piss the newcomers off, but my life's so good there should be background music. Most of the time. And that was a product of taking actions in the 12 steps. And to me, Alcoholics Anonymous isn't somewhere I go as much as it is a verb. It's something I do. You know, and that triangle, recovery, unity, and service, basically translates into three actions. Contribute, belong, and learn. Contributing is service, belonging is unity, learn is to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me from a spiritual experience. And by taking those actions, I feel wanted, needed, and loved. And I had no idea that that's what I came here for. It just blindsided me, you know, like a freight train. And, you know, if you're new, do what I was asked to do. I was asked to set aside everything I thought I knew about AA, about the 12 steps, about God, so that I could have a new experience with this thing. And do it at 5, 10, 20 years sober. I've seen people do it, you know, when they thought that everything had failed them, and have a brand new experience with this thing. And it's the most amazing thing in the world. You know, thanks for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.